again, an apology because, and this always happens with these talks, I've made it through about a third of the material I intended to cover. You give up. You do your best. I hope to. I would love to. It's been a joy. As I said, speaking to a group of fellow traditionalist Catholics is wonderful. It's a real treat. And to be able to speak on the Bard in his native land is astonishing. I was telling friends, it will be a perfect trifecta now. It's a horse racing term. You have to hit the first three horses that come in. I was lucky enough to be invited to speak on Dante in Italy. And then last summer I spoke on Dostoevsky in Russia. And now I'm speaking on Shakespeare in England. It's a dream come true. They're my three favorites, I think. And it's a great treat to be able to do that. So there are things I haven't gotten to, but I think you have a general outline of my view of the romances. You should go exploring in them now. You should have some means of understanding. They're strange, odd, peculiar works filled with action, miraculous design, and beautiful poetry. The poetry, I've neglected the poetry. They elevate us. They lift us up. They're a vision of glory. This lecture on The Winter's Tale is going to be a little different. I have talked on The Winter's Tale before, and you can get a hold of those tapes from the seminary in the United States. That will give you my overall view of the play, which follows the romance pattern that I was talking about. Much more to say about that. But to end today, what I want to talk about is how The Winter's Tale has elements in it that show us that Shakespeare was speaking to the Catholics in his audience in his own time, and doing so in a way that did not disrupt or threaten his role as a public playwright working in the king's company. His boss was King James I, and he was forced, if you will, to do two things at once. He was a loyal subject of the king, there's no doubting that. It's clear he was horrified by the gunpowder plot. If it actually took place, planned by Catholics, that's another story. We don't know. Some other time. He was also, by this point, much more open, I think, in his associations with the Catholic community in London, and speaking to them more openly in the romances than he had in many years. As I said, Claire Asquith, in her book Shadow Play, talks about the hidden beliefs and coded politics of William Shakespeare. That's the subtitle. I was surprised the book was as well received in the United States as it was. The local rag that I read every morning called the Washington Post, dreadful newspaper, I pick it up every morning, my blood pressure goes up, my doctor tells me I need to do three things to get my blood pressure down. I've got to lose weight, exercise, and stop reading the Washington Post. Nevertheless, all three are bad habits. The review was superb. Absolutely superb. A rave review for this book. Happened in many other major United States papers. But over here, she's being hammered by her own. It often happens. They do not want to admit to the claim she is making. I will agree there are moments in the book that go too far. There are some things I would love to chat with her. I disagree with a few things. I think there are some small mistakes in the book. I've noted a few errors. I read a review recently that simply said the book's to be dismissed because there's this minor mistake here, that minor mistake. Not, you know, you don't deal with the principal theme. You find a small mistake, you dismiss the work. That's nonsense. You can't do that. So one thing I want to do in this talk is back up this good lady, this bright lady, this courageous lady who has opened a whole new area of Shakespeare scholarship. It had been going on for a while. The granddaddy of this whole movement is a Jesuit priest named Father Peter Milward, who spent his career teaching in Japan. Those students in the world now who know the most about Shakespeare's Catholic background and how it shows up in the plays are Japanese. There's no understanding these things. It's very curious. Then the historians came in, and the historians have been doing very good work unearthing things from Shakespeare's life that show connections. But what Claire Asquith has done is she has begun pointing out some of the literary connections, the ways in which there are coded messages in the plays directed at the Catholic audience. There is one other thing that has to be said, and this is the sad nature of modern scholarship. Before she published this book, she wrote an article that was printed in the TLS, which I do try to read, even though 80% of it is nonsense. But still, there's about 20% occasionally that's well worth reading. Some good stuff in there. She wrote an article about Shakespeare's poem, The Phoenix and the Turtle, which for 400 years has been a closed book, a mystery. He wrote it, published it in 1601 in a collection of verses based on the legend of the phoenix and the turtle, the emblems of undivided love, love that cannot be destroyed. Many poets contributed to the volume. Shakespeare's poem is obviously the greatest. People have known it had to make reference to a specific couple, but nobody could figure it out. And the poem is the closest that Shakespeare ever came to writing metaphysical poetry. Poetry in the manner of John Donne, Richard Vaughan. It wasn't his usual style. That is, elaborate metaphors, intricate intellectual games and puzzles. He usually didn't do that. He does in this poem. They knew it meant something. Nobody knew what it meant. Claire Asquith made an attempt at it. And it was an interesting... She tried to unlock the poem. Very interesting article. And then a couple years later, two gentlemen, one who teaches philosophy at Oxford and a law professor at Louisiana State University, unlocked it completely and wrote and published in the TLS an airtight argument as to why the poem was written, when it was written, and for whom it was written, and line by line they explored the poem. This is a poem that has been inaccessible in terms of its actual meaning for 400 years. Claire Asquith, to her credit and proving herself a real scholar, wrote to the TLS and agreed with them and said she got things wrong. They got it right. Not one letter came in opposition. Their claim is that the poem was written for English martyr Anne Lyne, who was put to death in February 1601. What was known was that after her death, the Catholic community in London retrieved the body from the ditch in which it was thrown. She was hanged at Tyburn. From the ditch in which it was thrown, And there was a private service done for her by the Catholic community. William Byrd wrote an anthem, and Shakespeare wrote a poem in her honor, The Phoenix and the Turtle, referring to the love between her and her husband, Roger Lyne, who had been exiled to Belgium 10 years before. They both converted, were disowned by their families, cast out, and he was sent into exile. He died there almost immediately, and she was hanged in Tyburn. But their love, their marriage, was pure, and they held to the faith. And Shakespeare writes the poem. No scholar has disagreed. No one has come up with a counter-argument. And it is as if the article had never been published. It's a non-article. It does not exist. It is not on the radar screen. These gentlemen found what I call the smoking gun, proving Shakespeare was connected to the underground Catholic community in London in 1601, and we can't refute it, so what do? We ignore it. It never happened. It wasn't written. I wouldn't be surprised if you went to the local libraries to find the article cut out of the TLS. It is totalitarian. It is very like Galina Vishnevskaya when she and her husband, Mstislav Rostropovich, took in Solzhenitsyn when he was being hounded by the Soviet state. And when they did it, their concert tours were canceled, and she went to the Bolshoi the next day to sing Madame Butterfly and was assigned the maid's part, Suzuki, and walked out and never sang at the Bolshoi again, and on the way home stopped in a record store, picked up her recording of Tosca, and her name had been blacked out. That's what's going on now, folks, in the scholarly community. They will not let this in. It's not that it's not printed, it's that it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. I will tell you a curiosity. This isn't my pride rankling me. This is simply another example. When the agreement was made between Campos and the Vatican, the National Catholic Register, one of the big Catholic newspapers in the U.S., called it one of the most important stories of the year. And mentioned that the situation in Campos was one of the most interesting situations in the Catholic Church in the post-Vatican II era, and said there's only one book you can read about it called The Mouth of the Lion. When my book was published, it never received one review. Not one. It is a non-book. It is in perhaps 5% of American libraries. It doesn't exist. Totalitarianism does not have to just kill, it can ignore. The late great works of Michael Davies were never reviewed. Just ignored. If you are anywhere in the traditionalist Catholic camp, or presenting Catholic material about the past, you don't even have to be a traditionalist. And Claire Asquith is not a traditionalist. She is a Catholic doing work about the Catholic past. Will just be ignored. It's not good. Which is why you need to some degree to know what's going on and state it as fact. Shakespeare was a Catholic. How do we know? He was raised in a devout Catholic family. His mother came from one of the most important Catholic families in the area. His father was a Catholic. His name is on the list of recusants, as is Shakespeare's daughter, Susanna. What's the missing link between grandfather and granddaughter? It's called daddy. We ignore it. We know for a fact he wrote The Phoenix and Turtle in honor of an English Catholic martyr who was killed at Tyburn. Curious thing for an atheist to do. We know he received last rites at the time of his death. We have the letter written by the Protestant minister who was in Stratford who said, Master Shakespeare died a papist. Pop. It's a wonderful thing. It was known. It was known. But most importantly, as I've tried to make clear, the plays tell us he was Catholic. Everything in them just shouts Catholic ideas, Catholic doctrine, Catholic values, everywhere. Well, they can dismiss it if they like, but it, excuse me, there is truth and the truth will prevail. So God bless all these people doing this work, Catholic, non-Catholic, whatever, let it continue. I had made this claim that Shakespeare had to be Catholic my whole career, and again, a wonderful blessing as I near retirement is it's all popping up everywhere. And one just simply has to state the fact. Don't let them intimidate you. It's a fact. Shakespeare was Catholic. I think he went through a period of grave doubt. It's a little play called Hamlet. He worked his way through it. He worked his way through it. Now, what I want to do in this lecture, I'm going on, is point out a couple of things in the Winter's Tale. I just realized I need a notebook. It's right here. That nobody knows about. You heard it here first. The question was asked earlier about the notion that Shakespeare was writing towards young Prince Henry. I think it is true. She makes the claim. It makes perfect sense. I think it's absolutely true. It follows the pattern of the romances. Hermione is falsely accused by her husband of being immoral. It's not true. Okay? It's a false accusation. She's a good woman. But he puts her on trial. It's terrible suffering. Terrible suffering. He has his own daughter taken off to be abandoned to die out in the wilderness. She is saved. The one who takes the baby off and leaves it there gets a the most famous stage direction in Shakespeare. Exit pursued by a bear. Yeah. So we know what happens to him. There's instantaneous punishment. We go through the perils and the ordeals, and then we have our resolution, having suffered and gone through the pain of that suffering, recognition, reunion, miraculous ending, the resurrection of Hermione, who appears as a statue. Well, we'll read through it in a bit. We'll end by letting him speak for himself. Enough of commentary. I'll end by looking at the scene. Now, Claire Asquith points out, she's absolutely right. In the source material, Robert Greene's Pandosto, Leontes is the king of Bohemia. The figure goes crazy, falsely accuses his wife, he becomes madly jealous, out of nowhere, says, she's having an affair with my friend, that child is not my child, and we have a terrible situation, and they have to flee from Bohemia to Sicilia. Shakespeare reverses it. And people have long wondered why he took the source material and sets the play in Sicilia and then they flee to Bohemia. It's very simple. Bohemia, at the time that Shakespeare was writing the play, was a place that was welcoming English Catholics who had to flee from England and hide somewhere. In fact, you may not know this, but a gentleman named St. Edmund Campion was ordained a priest in Bohemia. Bohemia was the place where when you were accused and need to flee, you went and hid out. gee, I wonder why he made the change.
Doi.
When you know that, it's one of those obvious things. Now, who would have known that in his audience? Those who are simply living very contentedly with the religious changes of the time? No, they wouldn't have known it. Those Catholics who were being persecuted and went to the Globe to watch The Winter's Tale see the good characters who are persecuted fleeing to Bohemia. You know what went on during the performance. First performance. We don't know who they were, but they're sitting here, they're sitting there, they look at each other and go... It's a code, but it's obvious. She is absolutely correct in making these claims, but here's a dandy one concerning The Winter's Tale. This is not mine. This came to me from one of my students. We call this a dramatic pause. I did a seminar on the romances. Spent the whole semester studying the romances, had wonderful students. It was one of those happy moments as a teacher. By the way, out of it, tangents. A young woman who was about to graduate from the Naval Academy and enter the Marine Corps to become a pilot takes the romances seminar. At the end of it, she's fascinated with the Catholic faith. She wandered into the office. She converts during the summer before going to Quantico for training. Gets there and says, I can't fly. She's, right, you've got a flight billet. You have to. No, I can't. Why? Religious reasons. She's sent to the commandant of the Marine base in Quantico. Why are you giving up your flight billet? Because I converted over the summer, I become a Catholic, I don't believe women should be in combat, I will serve in the Marine Corps in any capacity, I can't fly. It's against my religion. He said, I'm Catholic. I have no problem with it. And they debated for 2 hours. She gave up her flight billet, she worked for the Marines, she was a Marine Corps officer for 5 years, left the Marines, and is now a Franciscan nun. The first case of a Marine Corps officer becoming a nun. That's the same seminar. Anyway. So I told them, for your final seminar paper, pick something that interests you. Find something you want to write about. I'm not going to give you a topic. You've read the plays, we've talked, something that find a topic. All right. So a young man in the seminar sits down, decides, and he was in the process of converting at the time. Rob Morrison, he's getting his law degree right now at the University of Chicago. Sits down at his computer and says, I'm very interested in the figure of Camillo in this play, the servant. King Leontes' loyal servant, who's by his side, has been with him, does everything for him. That's an admirable character. I think I might like to do my paper on Camillo, the loyal servant. I wonder if there are any people in history who are named Camillo. Why did Shakespeare choose the name Camillo? Now, this is the advantage of the internet. Clickety-clickety-click. Camillo. Types it in. What comes up? Only one famous Camillo in history. Camillo Borghese. Otherwise known as Pope Paul V, elected Pope May 16, 1605, died January 28, 1621, the reigning Pope when The Winter's Tale is premiered. Ding, 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 ding. Now imagine, if you will, you're talking to some of your Protestant friends and you begin talking about Benedict XVI. He's the Pope. Yes, he's the Pope. We saw him on TV last night. Yes, he's the Pope. How many of them would know that his first name was Joseph? Joseph Ratzinger. The Ratzinger they might have known of because of the media, the Joseph who knows But most of you know the name Joseph Ratzinger. Why? You're Catholic. The play opens, first scene. Enter Camillo, first character to walk on the stage, and Archidamus. If you shall chance, Camillo, to visit Bohemia on the like occasion, whereon my services are now on foot, you shall see, as I have said, great differences between our Bohemia and your Sicilia. Camillo, I think this coming summer the king of Sicilia means to pay Bohemia the visitation which he justly owes him. We all have to go, especially the king, to Bohemia. I could go through the play. Let me state very simply. Camillo is the good servant who behind the scenes is attempting to arrange events to the good for everyone. He's always there. When his master, King Leontes, goes nuts and says, my wife is untrue, she has had relations with my best friend Polixenes, that child is his, not mine, Camillo tries reason, which doesn't work, and then goes to Polixenes and says, you've got to get out of here fast. I have been ordered to kill you. I will go with you to Bohemia. We have to leave this kingdom. The king's gone mad. And when the time comes, at the end of the first Act 1, Scene 2, when they're leaving, we get the following lines. Polixenes says, I'll go with you. Yes. I don't know how to get out of here. I mean, what? You have a king visiting another king, and one of the kings has to flee. He's got to escape, or he'll be killed. Polixenes says, how do I get out of here? And Camillo says, this is the end of Act 1, Scene 2. It is in mine authority to command the keys of all the postures. Can you imagine the Catholics in the audience? The Pope's there, he's behind the scenes, he's working. The Pope's there, he's behind the scenes, he's doing what needs to be done. Okay? Now, Leontes is furious. His trusted servant has helped this evil man escape. He can't believe it's happened. I'm getting ahead of myself. He's telling Camillo what's gone on and expects Camillo to assist him. And simply talks about Camillo's loyalty. I have trusted thee, Camillo, with all the nearest things to my heart, as well as my chamber councils, wherein, priest-like, thou hast cleansed my bosom. I from thee departed, thy penitent reformed. That's just wonderful stuff. It pops up all the way through. I won't carry on from that other than to say this. This play is saying indirectly to Catholic underground devout playgoers, the Pope's in charge. Trust the Pope. He's back there. He's doing what he can. Be patient and endure. This has never appeared anywhere. I'm going to write up an article about this and go through the whole thing, of course, mainly to support Clara Asquith. The word, no. She doesn't know what she's talking about. What, this is an accidental? Camillo, the name of the Pope, talking about controlling the keys to all the posterns. Excuse me. It's unmistakable. It's unmistakable. And by the end of the play, in the return journey, because King Polixenes in the next generation comes to attack his son, the prince wants to marry this simple shepherd girl. She's not. Her name is Perdita, the lost one. She's the daughter of King Leontes. Camillo arranges it so the young couple can flee back to Sicilia, where Leontes is now doing penance and has done penance for years, admitting his error, and that he killed his wife, killed his youngest son, lost his daughter. Camillo's the one who arranges their return. Now, there's another character in the play called Paulina. When the king goes nuts and starts all this, she is this magnificent woman who stands up and defends the queen and has the gall to tell the king directly, "You're wrong, here's how you're wrong, snap out of it, I don't care if you're the king." And Claire Asquith has a magnificent depiction in her book describing the woman on whom this character, Paulina, is based. Maudlin Brown, Viscountess Montague, second wife of the Viscount Montague, who had spoken out against the oath of supremacy at the beginning of Elizabeth's reign. By 1608, she had been a widow for 16 years. In the play, it's Paulina's husband who's eaten by a bear. She's a widow for 14 years. Everyone was terrified of her. She was so imposing and so outspoken that they allowed her to keep... She could carry on Catholic devotions in her home. Elizabeth herself was plainly awed by her. Almost alone among prominent Catholics, she was permitted to practice and indeed to flaunt her religion unmolested. You just didn't mess with this lady. At the end of the play, after the miraculous return of Paulina to her father, the resurrection of Hermione, the dead wife, the reunion of the family, the last thing that happens is Leontes, Paulina says, "I, an old turtle, will wing me to a withered bough and there live out my life. I'm old, I'll just, no, I'm very happy, things are, and I'll go away." Leontes says, no. "Camillo, come here. You're to marry her." And the two are joined. Who? Camillo, Peter, and Paulina. Just a wonderful moment. The audience would have been delighted because, and there's always a laugh. The old servant and the older woman get together and get married. They're good people. We like it. It's delightful. They're good. They deserve each other. It's a wonderful theatrical dramatic moment for the Catholics. Peter and Paul. The one who defends the faith, controls the key, and the one who is the apostle. Talking, telling you what you need to know. And they are one. And they're joined together at the end of the play. But Shakespeare wasn't Catholic. Here's the other one. Leontes is having what we would call a nervous breakdown. Act 2, Scene 1. He reflects on his own insanity. Please notice what happens in this play is quite simply the king goes nuts. Is a very nice family ruling the realm. Things are fine, and then he decides, My wife is not pure. He just goes nuts. It's original sin. It's a fall. And just boom, it just happens. But then he broods on it. And as he broods on it, he obsesses on it in a way that is totally unhealthy and talks about his own obsession. And when Camillo flees with Polixenes, see, that proves it. They ran away, they're all guilty. how blessed I am in my just censure, in my true opinion, alack for lesser knowledge, how accursed in being so blessed. There may be in the cup a spider steeped, and one may drink, depart, and yet partake no venom, for his knowledge is not infected. But if one present the abhorred ingredient to his eye, make known how he hath drunk, he cracks his gorge, his sides, with violent hefts. I have drunk and seen the spider. If you don't know the evil around you, then it doesn't bother you. That is, you may have a cup, the spider falls into it, you drink it, spider and poison, you didn't see it, you don't know, you're fine. But if the spider falls in the cup and poisons the cup and you see it and drink it, you're poisoned because you now have knowledge of the evil in the cup and it will destroy you. I have drunk and seen the spider. I had a friend call me on the phone. He'd gotten a book that's been reprinted called The Birthday Book of the English Martyrs, originally published in the early years of the 20th century, in which on each day the author takes those martyrs who died in England and records their names and then has little incidents, episodes, little poems, little comments by them, memorializing each of the English martyrs. And a friend of mine who had the book would call me occasionally, and I would say to him, because he had the book, well, what's in the birthday book of the English martyrs today? And he'd read it to me, and, you know, you'd say a little prayer. So he called one night, and we chatted for a while, and I said, well, what's in the birthday book of the English martyrs today? And he said, well, I'll grab it, it's right here. He gets the book, and he reads to me. Birthday book of the English martyrs by Dom Bede Kamen. Published in 1908. March 31st, Venerable Stephen Rousham, priest, convert, martyred at Gloucester, 1587. Here's a little episode. Once, as the Venerable Stephen Rousham was saying Mass in the Church of St. Stephen in Reims, not long after his ordination, a large spider, crawling on the roof, fell into the chalice as he uncovered it to adore the precious blood. He was sorely disturbed and quite at a loss what to do. At last his simplicity, swayed by his great piety and devotion to the Blessed Sacrament, won the day. Having silently invoked the divine assistance and commended himself in spirit to the mercy of Christ, he bravely swallowed the spider together with the precious blood and suffered no hurt thereby. He saw the spider. I have drunk and seen the spider. No, no, no. A good Catholic priest, a devout Catholic priest, spider in the chalice, precious blood. I commend myself to God, drank it all, and suffered no hurt thereby. Do you think the English Catholics at this point didn't know that story? And weren't aware that when Leontes is saying, you can't do it, you can't do it, they didn't shout out, Venerable Stephen Rousham did. Why is that passage in there? To whom is he speaking? Accident. Just accident. No connection with anything. Shakespeare wasn't Catholic. No. It grows tires. It grows tires. Now let me say, it is not a Catholic tract. It's a great play. It's a great work of art. It's a very moving theater piece. It's a romance along the lines of what I defined earlier as a romance. But it is loaded with little signposts, if you will. Little moments of comfort and consolation for those in the audience who are struggling. And there it is. Let me end with one of the most miraculous scenes he ever wrote. Perdita has come back to her father. There's a reunion scene, but he doesn't give it to us on stage. He narrates it. We hear about the reunion of father and daughter by gentlemen who were there and witnessed it and tell us about it. Why did he do that? That would have been a great scene. Because I think he decided you can't have too many climaxes, and he's waiting for the big one. So we get this one secondhand, but also because we learn about it by hearing. Faith comes by hearing first, and then we get to experience it directly. Paulina takes Leontes and the recently found daughter and her new fiancé Florizel, the young prince, and Polixenes, who's come from Bohemia, reconciled with his old friend, and Camilla to her chapel, where she says she has had a statue of Hermione put. And she's going to show them this magnificent statue that has been created by Giulio Romano. He was an actual painter and sculptor of the Renaissance. People puzzled why Shakespeare chose the name Romano, the Roman. It's not a puzzle to me. She reveals the statue and says to the king, comes it not something near? Her natural posture. Chide me, dear stone, that I may say indeed thou art Hermione, or rather thou art she, and thy not chiding. For she was as tender as infancy and grace. But yet, Paulina, Hermione was not so much wrinkled, nothing so aged as this seems. So much the more our carver's excellence, which lets go by some 16 years and makes her as she lived now. Oh, now she might have done so much to my good comfort, as it is now piercing to my soul. Oh, thus she stood, even with such life of majesty, warm life as it now coldly stands, when first I wooed her. I am ashamed. Does not the stone rebuke me for being more stone than it? Or we could say, does not the rock rebuke me for being harder than it? And we have a play on stone and rock. What's the rock on which I will build? What is the pure, undefiled bride and mother? It's the church. What did the king cast off? The church. What is he sorry about now? Having lied about the church and said that she was impure, not worthy of him, cast her out, and now recognizes she is not only pure, she was the best. And the stone rebukes it. O royal peace, there's magic in thy majesty, which has my evils conjured to remembrance, and from thy admiring daughter took the spirits, standing like stone with thee, mother and daughter, both stone-like, rock-like. Paulina, give me leave, and do not say 'tis superstition. That was the accusation. Those Catholics, superstition. You hear it in the sadly, within the church now. It's all superstition. That I kneel and then implore her blessing. Lady, dear queen, that ended when I but began, give me that hand of yours to kiss. Oh, patience, the statue is but newly fixed. The color is not dry. I'm leaping ahead. Leontes is so obsessed with what he's seeing, Paulina says, I need to draw the curtain. My lord's almost so far transported, he'll think anon it lives. Oh, sweet Paulina, make me to think so 20 years together. No settled senses of the world can match the pleasure of that madness. What? Madness? The dead can come back to life? Let's alone. I'm sorry, sir, I have thus far stirred you, but I could afflict you farther. Do, Paulina, for this affliction has a taste as sweet as any cordial comfort. Still methinks there is an error comes from her. What fine chisel could ever yet cut breath? Let no man mock me, for I will kiss her. Good, my lord, forbear. The ruddiness upon her lip is wet. You'll mar it if you kiss it. Stain your own with oily painting. Shall I draw the curtain? She stops. And now the moment comes and says, Paulina, if you can behold it, I'll make the statue move indeed, descend, and take you by the hand. But then you'll think, which I protest against, I am assisted by wicked powers. What you can make her do, I am content to look on. What to speak, I am content to hear, for 'tis as easy to make her speak as move. It is required that you do awake your faith, then all stand still. Or those that think it is unlawful business I am about, let them depart. Proceed, no foot shall stir. Music, awake her, strike, and music sounds. And it's not rap. You have to have harps, flutes. 'Tis time. Descend, be stone no more, approach, strike all that look upon with marvel, come, I'll fill your grave up, stir, nay, come away, bequeath to death your numbness, for from him dear life redeems you. You perceive she stirs, and the statue steps down. The dead Hermione returns. Start not, her action shall be as holy as you hear my spell is law. Oh, she's warm, says her husband as he touches her. If this be magic, let it be an art lawful as eating. The accusation against the Catholics, magic, hocus pocus. No, as simple and lawful as eating. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, there shall be no life in you. That she is living, were it but told you, should be hooted at like an old tale. But it appears she lives, though yet you speak not. She turns the mother around and says, kneel and pray your mother's blessing. Turn, good lady. Our Perdita is found, and mother and daughter are reunited. Just unbelievable. Hermione speaks for the first time since she died in the third act. You gods look down, and from your sacred vials pour your graces upon my daughter's head. Tell me, my own births have been preserved. Where lived? How found thy father's court? For thou shalt hear that I, knowing by Paulina that the oracle gave hope thou wast in being, have preserved myself to see the issue. She preserved herself through her goodness, her virtue, her devotion, her innocence. Explore these plays. They are the glory of dramatic literature. They are the glory of your greatest writer. They are the glory of the devotions of a Catholic genius. And they'll tell you mysteries that we can hope for and attain if we keep the faith despite the world and what it may do to us. Thank you very much. Yes.
The audience for the Catholic connection. I find that quite difficult to believe, actually, but unless they Did they know before they're doing this, this was written for them?
No. Although, they had to know that Shakespeare was in sympathy with them, one of them. I suspect it was mainly known in private circles. But when they heard these things, they would have known some of these stories, they would have known the names. Again, it's the sort of thing you don't talk about publicly. Why did he write fairy tale plays? He couldn't write openly on the stage what he believed. And why all the talk of the classical gods, the mythical gods? Because it was forbidden by law to mention God on the stage. You couldn't even name God. We have two editions of Othello. First one, the way he wrote it, and the second one, after the law came out, you can't mention God, stripped of all the references. So he can't talk about it publicly. Well, then how do you get around it? You write these fairy tale plays, and you invoke the classical gods, and you allow people to make the connections on their own. He could not write directly what he believed. But it seems to me fairly clear, because they were trying to stamp out everything Catholic. If you don't know the great book by Eamon Duffy, The Stripping of the Altars, you must read it. He's a historian who has gone back. The word was that everyone went along easily when the changes came. No, not at all. It was a battle. It was a great battle. And Duffy chronicles it. It's a magnificent book. Must read.
One of the reasons the parallel between Catholic community is drawn by Clarice herself, because she was living in Russia with her husband.
Yes.
And the same thing is going on there.
It's magnificent, yes. Her husband was a diplomat in the Soviet Union. Claire Eskwin. She went to the theater one night with him. And came upon a little dramatic setting of a Chekhov short story. And in the midst of it, she found the audience. And she didn't know what they were chuckling at or responding to. And it dawned on her there were all these buried references to the contemporary political situation in the play, innocuously presented and covered. And the KGB agents standing in the doorway were paying no attention. It was going right over their heads. And she said to herself, that's very curious. Well, of course the theater would be a good place to do that. I wonder if in another time of repression, England, at the time of Shakespeare, if he was doing anything like that. She went back and went through all the plays, looking for things, and it just... That's how it happened. But then we know that somehow the truth and things being set right are going to come out of Russia, don't we? A little secular example of it. So Russians, it's an amazing place. You have one more example. We'll be through Russia, but the Immaculate Heart of Mary will triumph.
You touched on the sonnets yesterday.
Yes.
But I just wanted to know if you thought there was anything autobiographical in them, Catholic or otherwise, or something else going on.
She has a couple of examples in the sonnets that are very interesting, especially the reference to St. Thomas More. I think one of my major quibbles with the book is I think she dates the sonnets too late. And I honestly think the sonnets are more personal than she allows. I think they are partially personal, partially literary. You couldn't be a great poet if you didn't do a sonnet series. I read them more personally than she does. I'd love to, that's one of the things I'd love to talk to her about.
Do you think it's worth looking for Dark Lady then?
I'm convinced there was a dark lady. But I'm not sure she was an emblem. I think she was a dark lady. if you see what I mean. Yeah. We won't know. I'm not sure anybody will ever unlock that mystery. It's private, we shouldn't. There are certain ways that we have the poetry. We have to call it a question. Not sure we should. I don't think that does have to do with the thing. I could well be wrong, but I don't yet have enough evidence. So, yeah.
It seems to be the reverse. There's a John Fisher in Harvard talked about the kingdom of Bohemia, who was asked to retract it, which was forbidden worldly in the early 16th century due to the Hussite rebellion. Is that linking with the play or not?
I'm not exactly sure. But what it does show is there are certain things you cannot say publicly in Parliament, but nobody cares much about the stage.
Right.
You can get away with things on the stage because everybody thinks drama is silly and frippery. Politics is important. The stage is... When in fact, of course, the plays last long beyond any knowledge of what's happening politically.
I meant to ask a second one, but in May Rise of Windsor, Young Will is questioned by Oliver Hudson?
No, it's...
He's a Protestant parson.
Yes, it's a Protestant parson.
Do you think that's himself, do you think?
Oh, that is, it's in Andrew Lycan. It's not Merrill.
Sorry, yeah.
It could well be, it's in Andrew Lycan. It could be a little joke on himself. It could well be a little joke on himself. He plays jokes on his name all the time. All the time. So it's the only character in the plays known as Will, and it's Young Will, and it's a very brief moment, and he could be poking fun at himself, which is very important because it's rare for an artist to poke fun at himself. Most of them take themselves very seriously. Could be a good sign. Yes, I think it's quite possible. Quite possible. Yes?
Yes, Dr. White, have you ever read the book by Hugh Ross Williams, The Day Shakespeare Died?
Oh, yes.
I don't know it.
It was published, you see, I think in the early 50s.
And I don't know it.
It makes the claims of Shakespeare's policies based on the textual evidence in the play. Now, it seems fairly clear that Claire Asquith hadn't read that book because she doesn't mention it anywhere in her list of citations. And I'm very annoyed. I read that book, lent it to someone, and...
Well, I just learned today most of the Williamson books are out of print, yeah. Yes?
Ah, yes.
Just one's been brought back into
really?
It.
Really? Yeah. Which means it may be hard to get a hold of.
I should think it is.
It's my earlier point. These things vanish. They're not held on to.
Devastating.
They need bringing back.
Well, actually, yeah. I've got an idea.
Mowbray's, the bookseller that used to be the High Anglican in Margaret's Green Oxford service, where there's a High Anglican church. It was taken over by Waterstone, and it's still in the base of the Waterstone. And that particular Waterstone building is about to be sold. And I said to the man studying at Mowbray's, and he said he didn't know what happened to Mowbray's. I think the society should buy it.
We're going to open the appeal to buy Mowbray's.
There it is. You can find lost books on the internet. But again, no one knows.
Yeah.
It never becomes public. No one knows. I'm sure she didn't recognize this.
One of the masters at the grammar school, who checked it informed in the book.
Yeah, yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, that's absolutely. Yes, yes. It's frustrating, but never forget, we've read the end of the book. We know who wins in the end. It's going to be all right. What we have to do is persevere. And the times are going to get worse. So we need a whole lot of prayer, much sacrifice, be ready for the suffering. And in the meantime, read some beautiful poetry and drama to fortify yourself.
Do you think that Shakespeare is really the only playwright who needs to be bothered with?
No, there are many others. I think there are many. I love the Greeks. I love the Greek playwrights are astounding. I teach the Greeks more and more. Just trying to get my students to straighten out their mangled brains. The Greeks are logical and clear, and even in their drama, direct. There are other playwrights of Shakespeare's time, I know.
Who are 20th century?
Eugenio, yeah.
Very funny. I mean, there's some I am fond of because I knew them when I was young. It's difficult to make a determination. There are many playwrights worth doing, but I wouldn't make huge claims for them. Except one of the great playwrights of the 20th century is undiscovered. This is good. This is what I call a transition. I try to teach my students to do it. I have an opportunity. Many of the acclaimed playwrights will vanish. They're puny, they're tiny. They talked about little things of minor interest, and over time they will not survive. One man who read the romances and grasped them completely, in fact, Pericles was his favorite play, was an American turned Brit named T.S. Eliot. Eliot wrote 5 plays in which he used things he learned from the romances. They are so bizarre that they have been continually attacked. But after we crawl out of the rubble and they survive, people will understand. Eliot's not only one of the great poets of the 20th century, he's a major dramatist and will outlast hosts of others. If you don't know the Eliot plays, read them. They are fascinating. And much of it is based on separation, recognition, renewal, recovery. They're lovely plays. Murder in the Cathedral is the best known. It's a great play. The later 4, Family Reunion, Cocktail Party, Confidential Clerk, and The Elder Statesman. Lovely, lovely plays. Lovely plays. Absolutely just cast aside by the theater community and the intellectuals, and which is a sure sign there's something there. We're talking one of the great writers who, in fact, has the longest running play on Broadway. It's called Cats. He loved the theater. He knew something about theatricality. They're wonderful plays. I recommend them. Take a look at them if you don't know them. It's actually Mr. Eliot I'll be talking about tomorrow. That's my plan. I hope to see many of you there. Thank you.